Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And it's my honor to welcome Eric Fanning, the president and CEO of the Aerospace Industries Association, to the program on what is certainly an action-packed budget season. Eric, thanks so very much for joining us.
Vago, my pleasure. It's always always fun to speak with you.
Very, very much indeed. Thanks very much for making time for us. I understand we really know how busy you are. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Eric, and I said budget season. What I should have said is stimulus debate season. It is a chaotic situation, obviously. Democrats have passed two large packages. The sticking point with Republicans has been a liability exemption and aid for states and local governments. The president has been sort of on and off regarding an overall deal, but now wants a deal as big as Democrats have passed. It's a move that's opposed by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell rather adamantly. As we tape this, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Mnuchin were yet to meet again for the latest in a series of talks to try to hammer out something before the election. Where are we from your standpoint as somebody who's been engaging with folks, and what are the implications if Congress and the administration can't strike a fourth stimulus package?
Well, I wish I could tell you where we are. I've kind of given up predicting where this Congress is, particularly in this stimulus wave. But I'm not optimistic we're going to get something in the near term. And where it has the biggest impact on us is workforce and the supply chain, which are really overlapping things, because the supply chain really is built on a very talented workforce. But the commercial side of the industry has been hit really hard. And the customer, the airlines, not flying, not buying planes. And so there's a real concern that the manufacturers aren't going to be able to keep the workforce intact through this until the customer gets back flying and starts buying planes again. We don't want to lose that workforce. There's always a war for talent. We have an incredibly well-trained, educated workforce. If we lose it, it'll be hard to get it back, to build it back when things warm up again and people start flying again.
Do you any sense, on the magnitude yet on the industry? I mean, on a financial level, right? I mean, there were all these estimates, where the industry might need $20 billion, $25 billion. I mean, but is there, and how much money, for example, would have to go to DOD suppliers because of COVID-related costs and charges, right? I mean, do you have any sense on what that number is at this point? I mean, is it a $30 billion number, a $50 billion, $10 billion number? What, any sense at this point?
We don't have an impact number. What we do know, so on the defense side, the client, the Department of Defense, is still buying. So there is cash flowing through the system on that side. On the commercial side, the customer, the airlines, is not flying or buying. And we do know the impact that we're seeing on the commercial side. And globally, air travel is projected to be down 66% this year over last. It's almost 90% for international travel. And we project, the Wall Street Journal posted over 220,000 U.S. jobs are at risk because of this, with 100,000 in our industry already gone. 60% of the global fleet of aircraft is grounded. It's 17,000 aircraft when it's usually 1,500 at a time. And we think that production will go down 50% in 2020 from 2019. So it's grim on the commercial side. Why did I start with the defense side? They don't have two separate and wholly distinct supply chains. They're an overlapping supply chain, shared in many ways. A lot of companies in the supply chain want to have one foot in commercial, one foot in defense as sort of a risk mitigator for their long-term strategy. And with the commercial side shutting down, that is going to impact the defense side. Some companies are just going to stop doing what they're doing because they don't have enough business with the commercial side gone, and they won't be available for the defense side. And rates will likely go up because right. one of the things the Department of Defense benefits from is that shared overhead costs that some is billed to the commercial side and some is billed to the defense side. And if the commercial business is gone, all that overhead now goes on to the defense side.
Early in this pandemic, you and I have talked a little bit about this. Navy acquisition executive Hondo Gertz expressed the concern that as commercial manufacturing, right as airline travel stops, it's going to have a commercial manufacturing impact. And it's his point was exactly yours. You know, for F-18 and a lot of these aviation programs, the military business is a small portion of what they do for commercial industry. And now when that drops, any, you know, I know that some of the prime contractors have been moving to try to support key suppliers. What's the right approach here to make sure that that ecosystem, as you said in the beginning of the program, remains as whole as possible, right? Because some people are like, look, just go to capital markets. Money is still relatively economical. You know, get loans and commercially see your way through this. On the other hand, right, you can argue that some of this is important defense output. What's the right way to think about this so that we navigate it the right way?
Well, I don't think it's one way. I think it's a toolkit. We want as many tools as possible to get at this. Certainly, some companies are able to go to the private markets and get loans and stay afloat that way. But what the risk is that there are always weaknesses or potential gaps in the defense industrial base. The department spends a lot of time focused on that, Department of Defense, as do the primes. And they do what they can to make sure that those seams don't grow in a situation like this. But again, because of that supply, that shared supply chain, that shared industrial base, there are going to be companies that make strategic decisions to get out of the business. They're not interested in looking necessarily for some solution to get them past this COVID environment. They're going to look at how long the projections are to get back to healthy, back to normal on the commercial side, and say, we're just not going to do that line of business anymore. Then it becomes more expensive for the primes and for the Department of Defense, because they're going to have to pay extra money to keep that capability, that manufactured capability alive.
Do you have any different projections on how long you guys think it's going to take from your conversations, both on the commercial and on the defense side?
We don't know, and we're watching. I mean, obviously, the impact on the commercial side was fast and furious. The defense side has the benefit, as I said, of the customer still buying. You know, the budget was passed. The department is buying things for the warfighter. So there is money flowing through the industrial base as they continue to produce that product. And everyone is watching very closely where these problems are going to develop. In some cases, no matter how hard you try to understand your supply chain, you might not know there's a problem until there's a padlock on the gate of whatever that element is in your supply chain. So a lot of work is being done to try and understand where the problems are and address them before they develop. But because of how hard hit the commercial side is, we are going to see things creeping onto the defense side.
You mentioned unintended consequences, right? I mean, so some of these are known knowns, not to sound Rumsfeldian on you. Do folks in industry have a full assessment of what they think the impacts are going to be, the unintended impact? I mean, at this point, do you think that there's sufficient visibility where folks can say, okay, here are the concrete things I know I'm going to need to worry about? Or do you think that there are still some unknown factors out there that could intervene?
It's both. So as I said, the department historically does what it can, gathers the data it can to understand its industrial base and where there are problems, either where there are gaps that don't allow you to produce the capability you need, or where maybe you have exposure internationally in parts of your supply chain are too close to your adversary. And they're always trying to mitigate those types of things. So I think that there's a good understanding of the supply chain going into COVID, but there are still a lot of variables to play out. How long is this? How severe is it? What do individual companies decide is going to be their long-term strategy? Are they going to stay in the space, or are they going to get out of the space? And so I think, you can't monitor this too closely if you're trying to avoid having production delays or stops for the Department of Defense.
Are you seeing many people getting out yet? I mean, is that something that even in your membership is something that's being discussed?
I'm hearing it sort of anecdotally, but I'm not seeing a wave yet that concerns me that we're going to see massive gaps or fissures that show up in the defense industrial base. But we're already seeing where it's slowing down, certainly where it's going to be more expensive. Operating in COVID environment is more expensive. And again, if you lose that commercial business, which is gone for a lot of people right now, it raises the cost, the overhead costs and the costs on the defense side.
And I'm sorry, I should have made it a little bit clearer. So when I was saying, when I asked you about sort of the known unknowns and everything, what about on the commercial side? I mean, do you think that it's sufficiently understood there, right? Because the Defense Department does do quite a bit of industrial base management, both on a service level as well as a DoD level. But from a commercial side, do you think folks have got their arms fully around the nature of the challenges facing the industry writ large?
I think the magnitude of the challenge, yes. The projections that we're seeing on air travel from IATA haven't changed much in the last half of this COVID environment. And they're pretty ugly projections. It's going to take a long time for air travel to get back to where it's going. And so the focus is, as I said at the start, maintaining the workforce that maybe isn't working now or in the immediate future, but you want to keep whole so that you can ramp up the line when people start traveling again, and making sure that your industrial base, your supply chain stays whole so that you're monitoring closely the capacity of the supply chain or just the existence of it if some companies have to close shop or drop certain lines of business.
Let me ask you about the budget outlook. There was some optimism that we would actually get a defense budget. Unfortunately, we're still on a continuing resolution. The unfortunate thing is you spend most of your Pentagon career having to navigate life under CRs for prolonged periods of time. Any sense on what immediate impacts on this, life on CRs is going to be, at a time when we're trying to step up on great power competition, the department is facing COVID-related challenges. Any insight on the implications and the impacts from that standpoint?
Yeah, I don't think most people understand how disruptive and expensive CRs are. It's not an efficient way to spend money or to plan for money. I mean, it's hard enough to budget for the Department of Defense in 12-month increments, but when they're really 3 months, 9 months, 6 months, it's a very ineffective way to plan. And they don't allow you, as most people I think know, to do new starts. So a continuing resolution just says take last year's budget and take 2-3% off for friction and keep spending. So if you have a new start in your plan, it's delayed. And one of the problems we know from the defense acquisition process is the valley of death. It exists for established primes. It's particularly brutal for new entrants. And this just expands this. If you finally are getting something into production and then you have a CR, it's put on hold and just makes it that much harder for companies to do business with the Department of Defense. It's an enormously frustrating existence for those that are trying to build budgets and plan around them. More so than even what the top line is in the budget, if we could just get stability in the process, it would help things enormously.
Just to shift gears to workforce and talent management, I would commend people to check out your op-ed in Space News that the Space Force should break the mold in recruiting and retaining talent. That's something that is one of your passions, obviously. What do you think the Space Force should bear in mind as it goes, as moves ahead to stand up and is now the nation's newest military force? What do they need to bear in mind as they launch General Raymond's, the Space Operation Chief's workforce plan?
Well, first, let me say, I think General Raymond is bearing this in mind. I mean, everything that I read or hear him say is, in my view, sort of spot on seizing an opportunity here. And the opportunity is not just, the first military service in 70 years. It has some characteristics that I think give it more opportunities than the other services have had to address change in the 21st century. One is its size. We always looked at the Marine Corps as the smallest service, and Space Force is less than a tenth the size of the Marine Corps. So it gives it an opportunity to to pilot things, and if they work, scale them quickly or adjust them quickly because of its smaller size. The other is it is a service where virtually everyone, if not everyone, is going to be doing their work remotely, meaning not directly in harm's way, which gives it some additional flexibility in terms of requirements for those that it assesses, brings into the Space Force, both in the uniform side and on the civilian side. And that's where I think there's a lot of interesting flexibility. The Space Force should be able to reach out, appeal to, and attract a larger segment of American society than the other services are able to do because of the nature of how they fight. You know, we know that only 30% of 18 to 24 year olds are eligible for service from the start because of educational issues, criminal records, which are mostly drug related, and physical fitness standards. And you can set different requirements for a force that isn't fighting in harm's way, but removed from harm's way, and appeal to a broader segment and build career paths, family-friendly policies that I think will help with recruitment and retention and allow the Department of Defense to experiment with some personnel policies and ideas that have been talked about for years.
You know, you work these issues in the Navy, in the Air Force as the number two, and then obviously as Secretary of the Army. What's the key to getting that right? Because there is this tendency of thinking that as long as you have the uniform on, right, everybody's got to be able to carry a gun and be on the front line, even if some of our jobs implicitly are not those kind of frontline jobs, right? So what's the right way to sort of navigate this in a good way when you're looking at this kind of a talent management challenge, right? And there's the same question is, you know, it extends to cyber and a couple of other career fields as well, which was one of the things I know that you work very closely.
Yeah, so cyber is a great example. We bring in young men and women, we give them exquisite training, they finish their tour and the private sector comes and scoops them up at much higher salaries. And when you have sort of an up or out way of thinking about your force, once they're gone, it's hard to bring them back in. Space Force being a largely technical force, certainly a warfighting service, but a largely technical force, you can think about your workforce differently, how you split them between the uniformed and civilian side and potential lateral accessions where you're bringing people in mid-career or they come in and they go out and they can bring with them the advantage of what they learn and what training they get in the private sector and put that to bear on national security issues. And so there are a number of ways you can structure, build, and transition your workforce differently than you can in the other services because they are more kinetic, direct kinetic, those people in uniform than you'll need to have in Space Force.
Are you comfortable, right? I mean, when you look at commercial industry, there's an insatiable demand. I mean, and until the pandemic, right, it wasn't even certain that the nation would be able to generate the sort of 1.5 million, but Boeing always does that annual assessment, which I always find to be fascinating, right? How many commercial aviation jobs do we need to create? And at a time when we've got a lot of defense programs that are going from the developmental stage to production, right, that creates a whole bunch of other challenges, right, as companies focus on that kind of talented workforce to produce what we need. Are you comfortable that the industry's plans to kind of continue recruiting talent are robust enough for us to be creating those kind of scientific and engineering jobs at the end of the day the nation needs to stay competitive in a great power era?
Well, I am confident the jobs will be there. You know, we know that in our industry, the number of jobs that every year in our facts and figures is growing. The issue is creating the workforce. I do think that the industry and other industries, frankly, because again, it's a war across all industries for talent, are engaged in very robust plans to go after that workforce. But it's not just an industry or a private sector issue. You know, I'd say it starts with the United States educational system. And I do think more needs to be done to get kids interested in STEM and then provide them opportunities to pursue that through their education. Not everybody in aerospace needs to be a PhD STEM, but even our, you know, machinists are highly technical, highly trained individuals in many cases. And so they need to have that basis, that scientific basis. And so I would say this is not just an industry issue. This is a whole of United States issue to make sure that we're providing the right opportunities from an early perspective and then linking them into these good jobs.
And I should give a shout out to AIA for the extraordinary job it does in the international rocketry competitions that culminate by going to a major air show. And I certainly have my fingers crossed, Eric, that we're going to be able to see each other at the Paris Air Show and go to the rocket competition on the last day of the air show. And hopefully the American team will bring home the trophy. So.
Yeah, no, thanks for mentioning that. That's actually the favorite part of my job, which I didn't even know AIA did until I got there. These junior high and high school kids are pretty amazing in what they do. They would never have allowed me on the team when I was in school.
Let me ask you, speaking of workforce, it's an election year. Both sides have got transition offices working away. And the focus then comes on, hey, what are, you know, depending on who wins the election, again, we're keeping it nonpartisan here. But when the Obama administration went into office, you know, there was a ban on lobbyists. There was a concern that perhaps the administration would not want people with industry experience going and taking some jobs. The Biden campaign is echoing some of this language again, and that has some folks concerned that the department might not be able to access the kind of talent it needs. And at the end of the day, you're a living embodiment of the successful, a successful military-industrial congressional complex person, right? You had deep congressional experience. You've had a couple of tours, successful tours in two different administrations at the Pentagon, and now gained valuable industry experience as the head of one of the nation's most important aerospace and defense trade bodies. What's the right way to do this, no matter the administration? What's the right way to think about getting the best talent into the department? I mean, obviously on a civil service, right, SES, but particularly for the appointed leaders who are so critical in our system to get anything done.
I don't think any one thing should be sort of a unilateral element that keeps you from being able to serve. I start with, let's make sure we have strong conflict of interests rules and that they're enforced and that they're, you know, there's good oversight and that they're enforced. That ought to be the starting point. But I find that cross-pollinization and a breadth of experience is good for career development. Had I known, you know, this is my first foray in industry. Had I known then, during my 12 years in the Pentagon, what I know now, I think I would have been a better customer. Meaning I would have been smarter at spending taxpayer money more effectively. I think having an understanding of a partner, like industry is with government, makes you better on the government side. And so I don't think that sort of blanket rules are very effective at helping build the best team that you possibly can. But I do agree that when someone moves from one side to the other, and there's multiple sides here, there's academia, there are think tanks, there are all sorts of places where you look when you're building a team to come into government. But having that broad base of experience, I think, helps you put together a much better team.
Every year, Aerospace Industries Association issues its facts and figures. That's no longer the lovely hardbound book that everybody used to get and keep on their bookshelves, but it still contains critical data and statistics. And as you mentioned in the beginning of this conversation, Eric, right? I mean, obviously, nobody was counting on a centennial pandemic in order to sort of impact us the way that it has. But walk us through some of the numbers and what they mean insofar as they mean anything given where we are now.
Well, I think there are a couple of takeaways that we see every year. And of course, you know, our facts and figures numbers are from 2019, so they're pre-pandemic. And what jumps out to me is, first of all, the size of the workforce. The A&D industry has more than 2 million people in it, which was almost a 5% growth over 2018. It's high paying jobs, an average of almost $103,000 a year, which is 46% higher than the larger manufacturing ecosystem. And also just the impact, the economic impact. There were almost or over $900 billion in sales in 2019, which was an increase from 2018 of upwards of 7%. And the biggest trade surplus contributor, there was $148 billion in global exports, which accounted for $79 billion in trade surplus. So that's what I like to point out in all of this when we see the figures year after year after year, is it's a big industry, lots of workers being paid really well with a strong impact to American exporting numbers. But what that tells us when we go into a COVID environment in 2020 is our manufacturers see really a heightened impact from COVID because it's a global pandemic and because we are exporting so much, that it's not just the impact felt in the United States, sales in the United States, but it's the impact of sales felt globally.
And let me ask one last question. As negotiators continue to try to hammer out a fourth stimulus package, is there a message you have for them on your behalf and on the behalf of your membership about what they should bear in mind? I mean, sort of the importance of coming together and striking a deal, not just for your industry, but more broadly for the nation.
Well, so more broadly for the nation, people are hurting now. The impact that this has had on individuals' well-being, so many people being laid off. We see it on the commercial side with the airlines because people aren't flying and the airlines stimulus relief ran out. We've been advocating strongly on behalf of the airlines again because they're our customers. But one of the best ways to keep people whole, keep families whole, is to keep them working. And the aerospace and defense industry is, you know, one of the crown jewels of the United States because of the impact it has on exports, because of the quality of the jobs, because of the innovation that it fosters. And we want to make sure we can hold that workforce together until we get to the other side of the economic impact of this pandemic.
Eric, thanks so much for making time for us. Really, really appreciate it and look forward to having you back on again. Stay well in the meantime. Thank you.
Bago, thanks. Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.